Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So we're just past midwinter, and posted on coyotenetworknews.com is a really fabulous telecoyote that I did with Micah Nielsen, living embodiment of alchemical plant usage. It's very rich, and again, it's available now at coyotenetworknews.com. So we have navigated the end of the impeachment hearings, although in some way everything continues, and Adam Schiff, may he be honored and protected in perpetuity, could have played Leonard Cohen's You Want It Darker as a finale. And remember, Leonard left us with this song right before the 2016 election. So let's honor the dark and the underworld. We dive into the dark to get the remedy, the underworld medicine, where our souls can speak more deeply to us, right? So the moon is in Cancer now, as it is in our guest chart. I'll bring her in a moment. Reminding us history is the womb of time. It's a part of us that remembers what we need to remember now, what's been forgotten. The moon is opposite Jupiter, storytelling in Capricorn, the contribution of the woman storyteller, that we may tease into pertinent application all wisdom teachings flowing towards us now. We need everything. The moon is trining Neptune at the Eleusinian Mysteries degree, reminding us that humans had way of gathering their wits and aligning with the whole larger pulse of creation. Yes, and we remember this. All the images, mystery traditions that ever were or will be are available to us all now by our honed and customized affinity. So, suppressed until now, we welcome the return of Max Dashu, Moon in Cancer, that we may partner with everything to compost the war on life as nutrient to grow a culture of sane, reverent ingenuity and a wonderful life for the children of all species. So, Max founded the Suppressed Histories Archives in January of 1970. Oh, the medicine of long-term dedication to document women's history and heritage around the world and throughout time. Teaching with images is her way of making women visible across time and space. Her approach looks at historical dynamics that develop systems of oppression based on sex, race, class, the intertwining of these structural oppressions and liberation movements to overthrow them. Her website is fantastic, suppressedhistories.net. So many images, women's power, prophetic women, maverick women, witch hunts, everything, her fabulous book that I have here beside me, always at hand's reach, I will say, for real, witches and pagans, women in European folk religion. We got to know all this. So welcome, Max.
Thank you, Caroline. Oh, all the quintiles going on, huh?
Yes, all the quintiles. Let's honor those because we can open portals between worlds. But I have hosted you delightedly many times, but you got in touch with me because this is very important. You're celebrating 50 years of making global women's history visible. Do you want to, should we tout that? Should we let our team know?
Yeah. Well, you know, we're going to have a celebration in Richmond, California on Leap Year Day, which is February 29th. And just to kind of scope out all the whole vast spectrum, this whole reservoir of memory that we're all in the process of recovering. You know, it's like all the movements to decolonize, all the attempts to re-envision the positive roots. In order to cope with all of the direness, we have to have some kind of inspirational flow coming in to keep us focused in the center and not constantly reactive. And so a lot of what I've been doing is scanning the cultural record, looking first, my initial impetus is, where are women free on this planet, or where have women been free, and what are the other cultural modes that have been archaeologically buried in a lot of ways, you know, not just archaeologically, but in the way that people talk about civilization and great men and who the heroes are and all of these things that are usually in the mode of war and domination, you know, the way that educational edifice teaches us. But what else is there, you know, and what kinds of, it's like really a process of pattern recognition and seeing, oh, no, it's not just this one person or this one place, but there's this broader pattern within humanity, other ways of being, you know, authentic ways of being. And interweaved, connected ways of being, you know, with the biosphere, with nature.
Yes, And that's so much of your splendid book is about, you know, women would sing blessings into weaving magic as we do, you know, and the animistic kinship. And the Christian monks were like, no, and no gazing into water either. No reverie, right? Anyway, so, yeah, the Inquisition takes many forms, and I think, you know, inwardly and outwardly. But I love suppressedhistories.net, everybody, and your... delineation of your long dedicated research. I just excerpted a little bit because it's like, oh, I didn't know that. You said historical patterns emerged in which upper classes were more invested in patrilineage, multiple wives, and constraining women's bodies and behavior than was the case for commoners or indigenous people. That's why the Romans called the ruling classes patricians. I didn't know that. Of course, there it is.
I mean,
those
once
are the fathers.
You see it, you know it. You recognize, oh, well, yeah, of course. But, you know, it's...
Of course.
It's a concept that's just embedded in us without any interpretation. You know, there's no Mishnah for the cultural messages. You know,
right? And then just your last sentence there, because it's so spicy and like for everybody, like let's rummage around why veiling and female seclusion began with elites in Indo-European and Semitic society, and why foot binding and corsets arose among aristocrats before these customs spread to other classes and cultures. That's really intriguing. There's a lot to chew on in that, going,
Yeah, because, you know, there's this way that there's very important interconnections between systems of domination. So there's a correlation of class-ranked, hierarchical, militarized societies with male domination, and then there's also a correlation among the common people, because this is the other side of the Roman picture, is the word plebeians literally means the people. You know, and one of the Roman authors says, well, the plebeians know not their fathers. And they didn't have, there may have been the attempt in that time and period of history, you know. I mean, we are looking at a patriarchal society, but there's an idea that women are still, plebeian women are running the streets. You know, they're out there, they're working, they're doing things, and they have a greater measure of self-determination. You know, I mean, they're class oppressed, but, you know, than the women who are under the veil and, you know, under the rule of silence. I mean, there was, like, Roman protocols is that, you know, aristocratic women weren't supposed to speak in the presence of men. You know, stuff like that.
And that's a great example of, you know, a theme I keep working and teasing, which is prison masquerading as freedom. Going, step right up, you can be an aristocrat, you can be a patrician, just bind your feet, here you go, it's freedom. No, it's prison.
Yes.
Right, and so yeah, I think it's a good category for us to carry in our magic backpack, going, is this liberating or imprisoning?
Right, and there's one more aspect to that, because you're mentioning sort of a mental colonization, but there's also a way where women of the common classes aspired to rise out of their sort of survival challenged economics into a better status, and so they willingly took on the veil as a marker that, you know, I'm a decent woman. I mean, that was really the distinction that was being made, is this decency idea of modesty, you know. And so women would buy into that because the consequences of going around with your hair flowing out and in the sun, or, you know, with the corset, it was like at a certain point it became sort of this new cultural consensus that if you weren't wearing a corset, that made you a wanton, indecent woman, and you were fair game on the streets. So you also see these cultural forces pushing women, you know, in various ways into adopting behaviors as a kind of a camouflage of self-protection, you know.
Right, and I thought it was so interesting when I was lucky enough to be in the Sinai Desert with Bedouins and a Skookum group of people, and in the desert, see, a hijab is what everybody wants to wear because it's sensible and cool, and you can play with it and cover your
keep the sun off,
so that was a freedom. That was a freedom that then becomes an imprisoning rule. Right, everybody must.
Right, and then it also becomes at a later point in time, like if you look at how it was going for women in Cairo in the last maybe 30 years or so, putting on hijab allowed women to come out into the streets from seclusion because it gave them, they could go to university if they assumed a scarf. And that is a negotiation with patriarchal power, but it's also, I want out, you know? And so women are constrained in various ways, and we can't really have an absolute... I mean, I think one of our great dangers right now, in addition to splitting, is absolutism. And so, like, if you have an absolutist framework, then, you know, this thing is only bad, and we can't see how women are trying to navigate things where they're not really the ones who are determining all the terms, you know? And so there's that side of it as well. You know, the Muslim feminists would say that for them, it was a passport to the public sphere. You know?
Well, I gotta mention, and because we're inviting in ancestors and mythological and real, but wonderful Moroccan feminist ancestor now, alas, Fatima Mernizi.
Yes.
And she was talking about, we were talking about how Scheherazade saves the world, and she said, we got to a point where we go, anything that's anywhere is everywhere. And she said, right, the burqa in America is size 6.
That's right, and she also talks about makeup as the veil. You know,
women who don't feel
like they can go out in public without their makeup, you know, because they've been so conditioned by their culture. You know, it's just like you can have a failure to perceive because you're so locked into one framework. And that's why, you know, I'm saying absolutism, you know, it's just like if we judge, then we're not sort of seeing the context that women in different places are operating in and what might work for them. You know, and it's very, very complex because, you know, we don't want to be slicing off body organs and, you know, some of the things that have gone on, you know, in order to enforce, you know, this patriarchal order. But,
well,
you know,
we have to join together and listen to each other. A wonderful astrologer friend of mine, Heather Rowan, exploring many forms of relationship, and then her true love, she married a cross-dressing Native American cowboy, and that really worked. And so he would shave his legs, and she was like, "Wow, aggressively hairy legs." And he would just say, "For me, it's freedom. For you, it's freedom. Looks different." Mm. Anyway, fun. And then just briefly, can I? Is it okay if I bring up just a very brief little thing from John Berger, Marxist art critic, to
go
put
ahead
on our work table? So in his book, Ways of Seeing, which, again, I always have at hand's reach, there's a fabulous essay on the nude in art, and it's mostly pictures, but the gist of it is, he says, before industrialism and painting, we have naked people cavorting, la, 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 la. He said, once we got industrialism, for the first time ever in painting, we have the nude, almost always a woman looking directly out of the painting, watching the viewer watch her. And he said, this is the portable prison that women are conditioned to carry, one of them, that whatever they are doing, they are watching themselves do it, watching themselves weeping at their father's funeral, watching themselves make love, whatever. And so I think that's a useful frame. It's like, no, because we're in the Aquarius realm, which is all about image, which, of course, can be imprisoning or liberating according to our relationship to it. You know, do we choose it or is it imposed? And so for us to become naked, frolicking, is just an image I want to send out there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, that's an interesting instance that you bring up, because that thing of watching herself being watched, I think that is really in quote-unquote Western civ. That's become a dominant mode, because the representation of the female has been entirely in the hands of the male. And so there's this whole thing, not only that there were nudes, but the topics that were chosen, like if you're talking about Rubens, if you're talking about all these classic, you know, Baroque and Romantic painters, is this nude female as an object of this male gaze. You know,
right.
So that it's not an unconstrained, self-determined nudity of a woman who is not concerned with other eyes on her and the constructs that they're trying to push her in, but there's these pouting, posing, self-display kind of positionings in that art. Like there are paintings of Hypatia, who's, you know, this is a woman who was in her 60s. She's an astronomer. She's a philosopher. Mm. She's a major force in Alexandria politics, actually intervened against anti-Semitism, for one thing. And so she is now, in the movies, but also in paintings in the 19th century, being shown as a naked, posed woman with her hair flowing down, and just, it's like, this is not, and young. I mean, it doesn't look like Hypatia would have looked at the time when she was, you know, they were about to execute her. And so there's a way in which we have these cultural narratives that purport to be pro-feminine, but they're actually endowing the whole understanding of women's history with this almost a pornified framework, you know, so that we can't really see Hypatia. We see instead some man's romantic vision of a pretty lady, you know, in distress. And so, yeah, the nude, I think that's a very interesting point, you know, about that, Ways of Seeing. It is, there's another book, and I can't remember now the guy's name. I won't be able to even say the title of it, but he did a study of 19th century painting and the way that the passive woman, the fainting woman, even the dead woman, which we see sometimes in advertising even now, you know, as a culturally elevated, you know, it's this female as the object of the gaze, you know, as a pretty person who is not really powerful, who has no agency, who is not acting on, she's only acted upon. And it was a great critique, wish I could remember the name of the book. But
right,
yeah,
but,
so
but,
counter
but
to
I'm,
that.
But I'm, what, sorry?
Counter to that, the ancient female
yeah.
icons. You know, there's just a global pattern of self-representations in clay made by village women all over the world that are not like that at all. You know, they can be stout. They're looking straight out at you, or else they're in a mystical trance. You know, there's different ways of having it, but they're not posing for the outside gaze. They are centered and they're self-contained. And in publicizing this through my slideshows, and I did a poster called Female Icons, Ancestral Mothers, that kind of went viral on the internet because, you know, it was just so much, it was very, very international, and it was something that showed this is a completely different way of looking at things. We're really dealing with a totally different paradigm. But when we get so enculturated into the dominance modes of thinking across any axis, but certainly along the axis of sex and patriarchy, then we can see all kinds of other potentials that are not just potential, but actually lived history and lived cultural realities where there's honor and expression and speech and leadership in the female realm. And so, you know, we're all starved people who are looking for a few drops of dew to moisten our tongues, you know, and then actually that can become a torrent once you start, you know, following the clue down the labyrinth, and you find, well, there's actually this deep wellspring of cultural inspiration that's there. It's just that it's been cloaked from us, you know, by the gatekeepers of culture. And so we have to get past all of the editors and the people who choose the graphics for the Time Life books, summaries of the dawn of man and all these ways that we've been taught. Whiteness, too, not just the axis of sex, but the racialized dimensions. And then we begin to see the real picture. It's like there is a reality that's the sum total of human experience, and it's so much richer than anything that we've been given
to understand.
So I want to
bring in the immediacy of now, that all that you're speaking, we're all being danced into place, we're all practicing astrology without needing to know it, because the moon is trining Neptune. It's exactly what you were saying, the downrush of liberating imageries eager to pour forth. And just for the fun of it, it will be exact in 4 hours. There we go. Downrush, everybody, starting now, again, according to the calibration. So we do have the cauldron into which we can toss things. And I did want to just play a little bit with our chart and to and fro. So I said, well, you and I are two Sun, Neptune, square Uranus, Librans. So we heart heresy, encouraging free thinking and composting priesthoods. And using now for everybody the underworld rose salt scrub to remove any sneaky Inquisition Velcro attractors on our skin or the skin of our lives or our community spiraling out into the world. So I just wanted to, for all of our team, like, let's all animate this image right now. Here we are. We're all in the steamy, ancient, marbled bathhouses, suffused with the fragrance of roses, scrubbing away and scrubbing each other's backs, scrubbing away petty grievances, uncharitable thoughts, harumphitudinous finger wagging, you know, to emerge truly charismatic and even spicier. Anyway, I'm up for that.
It's like a Neptune trine like that is, you know, a Neptune in Pisces. It's like, you know, the hammam analogy is really good because it's like there's this way that Neptune in Pisces, it's like the mikveh, the original roots of the Jewish mikveh, where you immerse yourself into mayim chayim, living water. And it's like the essence of the water can just demagnetize out. There's a release that happens there. And that release, it's like the fairy tales that talk about before the wound can be healed, the death energies have to cleanse. So you pour the waters of death first, and the wound closes over because there's a healing in that. You know, there's something that's let go there. And then you pour on the waters of life, and it revivifies. And so, you know, there's first the release, the cleansing part, to take off the trauma, to pour out the pain, and then you become infused. You have the full capacity to be infused in the living waters, you know, and the living waters really is part of our consciousness, you know. But the waters, the waters, and the waters have been so much, you know, water is life, and all the movements that have arisen, that, you know, it's the reaffirmation of the sacred, you know, not in an abstract sense, but in an absolute, immediate, real way, concretely, you know. And
or something better than concrete, pathly or woodchiply, mulchly, mulchly, something like that.
Material, no, right? Material, right. Which is from mater.
Right.
You know, I saw something interesting that was Rebecca Solnit posted article that was actually a couple years old by Michelle Alexander in the New York Times, and it was called "We Are the River, Not the Resistance." And
yes.
Basically the point she's saying, every leap forward for democracy, from slavery's abolition to women's suffrage to minimum wage laws to the Civil Rights Acts to gay marriage, has been traceable to the revolutionary river, not the resistance. In fact, the whole of American history can be described as a struggle between those who truly embraced the revolutionary idea of freedom, equality, and justice for all, and those who resisted. And
yes,
she emphasizes,
I'm in complete
accord. We sang, right. "We shall overcome," and not "We shall resist."
resisting,
I resonate with resistance as well, but I just kind of like that, you know, the river.
No, but
the river.
Yeah,
metaphor.
No. We want to keep our metaphors fresh and tied to nature. You know, and so, you know, so I've been also for years saying, you know, the Dementors are the resistance. We are the swoosh, right? Absolutely. So it's in the memosphere that we feel this, and that would be, again, prison masquerading as freedom, going, come join the resistance, and like, come join the long, hard struggle. You know, whatever we say, we get more of. We want to join the effective dedication and triumphant, you know, honoring of life, and, you know, yeah. Again, just the play with all of that—that's really great. So you do have your wonderful event, but and you said it was, you know, images like nobody's ever seen. You said, which is,
well, that you've never been shown, really, because some people will have seen some of these images, but a lot of this stuff is buried so deep. You know, I've spent half a century digging around in libraries and archaeological reports and just trying to see, where are the women? You know, finding the women. And that includes the whole spectrum of the sacred, and not just the living women, but the ancestors and the divinities, and all kinds of different angles on that. But in doing that, you know, there's a way that it transforms you, because if you see it, you feel it. Just like, you know, with music, you get inspired. There's a way that images also have that potency, because it's not somebody's opinion. You can look at it and you can see how it's different, right? And so
right.
What I'm going to be doing on the 29th is showing people some of the cultural treasures. You know, I just finished, I don't know if you saw it, I posted this. There's a print that I just made called Mother Africa. That's the entire outline of the continent filled with some of the treasures from the rock art and the carved ivories and beautiful things, you know, Tonga baskets and all kinds of things that are just, those need to be on our radar. It's like we if we're inspired by the heritages, that's part of decolonization, is to remove those cloaks that have been thrown over things that are full of reverence and full of significance, full of meaning for us, you know, that we can learn from. Because
and maybe
the mass media has us by the, you know, has had us by the throat in many ways. People get very reactive.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for putting it in the past. That's so wonderful. That's really playful. You know, I remember when we were speaking backstage, I go, well, there is this new ancient part of the astro-mytho vocabulary, which I like a lot, which is Eris, goddess of disruption, way out in the Kuiper Belt beyond Pluto, so scientifically abstract, but mythologically completely hopping up and down. And so she's been stationing, along with Uranus, nature's, you know, liberating trickster ingenuity, and her image is for the degree where she's spending a long time is curtains blown inward in the shape of a cornucopia, letting in fresh air. So if you want to start before our break and then continue after, just what are some, from your wealth, the bounty you have dedicated and bestowed upon us, of some feisty, positive, disruptive, woofy women images that we might want to invite in now as part of our, and each person who feels by affinity going, yeah, two drops of that.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, there's the first thing I would throw out, and this just really is something that's still ongoing, is that there were four First Nations women in Canada who started a movement called Idle No More. This is before Sacred Stone Camp and the whole Dakota Pipeline thing, but it was also a defense of the waters and of the lands, you know, partly having to do with the tar sands and fracking and things like that, and Indigenous sovereignty especially. And so what they did, and this is something that's ongoing and continuing, is they danced the sacred round with the drums, with the traditional songs, and they were doing it in shopping malls. And they were doing it in town centers, in places that, you know, they brought the sacred in so that the political movement was completely integrated with the holy tradition, you know, with the sound of people joining together in dancing the round. And there's like a, you know, a base of that in nature. So it's those kinds of things. It's like, you know, also dreaming what you will weave with your life just on an individual level. You know, but they're inspiring to me. And then there are, I think that one of the things that comes through, some of the stories are very collective, like that one, and others have to do with like an individual figure who comes into historical focus if once we find out about her. So in Ecuador, there was a woman of the African diaspora named Maria Chiquinquira Diaz. And she was absolutely determined to free herself, and she never gave up. And all these obstacles, of course, are thrown in her path. But this was in Guayaquil in the 1700s, and she was the first enslaved person in Ecuador to win her freedom. And so, you know, she just did a legal battle to free herself and her daughter, and in that way she changed the course of history, just in her individual self-liberation. So those kinds of, I mean, we need to know these names and these stories, because that's the history that we're not shown. You know, we're being told about the war heroes, and we're told, I mean, you know, there's a lot of complexity to all of this, but it's
so
just like these.
Did you see the Harriet Tubman movie?
Yes.
I have not yet, but I read the grumpy reviews that said it's too magic. I go, oh, I could like that a lot. Well, did you like it?
I did like it. I mean, you know, there were ways in which there, you know, like how they do in movies is that it's more romantic, and it's like maybe not always the exact historical detail part of it, but it, the whole sweep of it, the feeling of it was this same feeling. She never gave up. She never let anything stop her. She was against these massive obstacles, and she pulled off really this spiritually this colossally spiritual achievement of freeing not only herself but hundreds of other people, you know, against just odds that are almost unimaginable, you know, navigating in the cold through the forests and across the borders, and, you know, paddy rollers are after them with hounds, you know, and she did it. And it was like that intention and that sacred determination that's like, I will do this, and I will save these people, and it's out of love. You know, the motivator for it is love. She's not after glory. She just needs to see this thing done, you know. And so that's something. I could also mention that you might kind of like this. There's a concept in Kikuyu culture that they call Gutura Mira Ngangya. And it has to do with an understanding. And this is not only in Kenya, but in many other parts of Africa.
Well, we're gonna take a very short break. Okay. This is too important to rush.
All right.
Hold that beauty right there. Our more than perfect for today guest is Max Dashew. Her fabulous website is suppressedhistories.net. So rich, so rich, so rich. She has some wonderful events coming up February 29th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. in Richmond that you can see on her website. We will continue after our break, and here is our very short break. Thank you, team.
shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Chiny, 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 come blow my chiny home. Indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. CoyoteNetworkNews.com is where you can find many things, including the Midwinter Telecoyote with Micah Nielsen that was so nutrient-rich, as is this radio hour with our guest, Max Dashew, founder of Suppressed Histories. Until now. Now they're out. Now she's been they're running
now.
For it. Well, yeah, she unlocked the cages. The stories are running free, and may it be that the story prisons known as conventional news, we have keys. We have keys. You know, in part thanks to Max. So there were many. I want to hand it back because you were right in the middle of or starting something very important. But I wanted to chime in that, in keeping with liberating hijinks and creativity, I have just received from Etsy. It was on back order. The fabulous Harriet Tubman stamps that you can put on every $20 bill that turns Andrew Jackson into Harriet Tubman. And it's legal.
Yes.
It's legal. And it's, okay. And you can have parties in which you just take 20s and stamp Harriet Tubman on top of it. So it's like, oh, isn't
it
charming?
It's How charming, is it legal? Right? Isn't defacing currency illegal?
No. The guy has a whole write up. It's not. It's something, but it's completely okay. You know, and I saw it from a neighbor, and I was like, I must have one. You know, they're out in circulation. May they all be that soon. We can see that anyway. So yeah,
that does it one better because I remember Native people, you know, like 20 years ago, were like Xing out Andrew Jackson's face on the 20s because you know his genocidal background with the
yeah. Right, no, this is good. This is a good, and it's very Venusian. So you were in the middle,
yeah.
But let me do a little frame. Well, let me do a little frame for your offering too. You know, since the Dementors have been manufacturing a delusional mob mind reality backstage, you know, it behooves us to conjure, you know, a collaborative with the desirable, with the likes of yourself and everyone who brings, which is the, you know, the desirable backstage reality that then we're going to all pull the switch on the reality train and have the positive atmosphere pour into the world. But so maybe that would make sense for the being you're about to introduce us to.
Now. Well, in some ways it is because, you know, this is something that, first of all, I have to preface this. This is not something that would necessarily work in our cultural context, but within the Kenyan cultural context, Guturamira Ngania was uncovering the power of the mother. And so police are descending on women protesters in Uhuru Park in Nairobi, where they're protesting. They want to keep the park for the people and not have condos built there for rich people. And so they're starting to arrest and beat up the young men. And so the elder women begin removing their garments and uncovering the mother. And I don't know what the translation is for Guturamira Ngania, but, you know, it's going to have some kind of sacred significance like that. And it stops the police cold because in that cultural context where there was still this idea of, you know, the mother has power in her body, armed men would turn away and run. And that same thing happened on the oil platforms when, I think it was the Ijaw woman in the Niger Delta, came up and were protesting because this terrible poisoning of their land was going on. And they, too, did the same thing. Troops are sent in against them. And it's like what I'm really getting here is the spirit of defiance that comes from an inner sovereignty, you know, and that fact that they had some cultural basis. I don't think this will work in New York. Well,
it would, no, it's got a shapeshift like a stratum amernesi mm-hmm. would be. The prison is gonna look different, so the liberation's gonna look different. Because it's true, yeah, our culture is so infantile that the boys would go, oh look, bosoms.
So that wouldn't work. There's no, there's no right away.
Right, but there's, you know, no, like, but
the way that the Chilean dance, you know, has spread all over the world, this feminist dance, and it's like, you know, this public group through dance and music reclamation of female sovereignty is something that really caught on. It just, like wildfire, shot around the planet, and so women are doing it in the Turkey, and they're doing it in all these different places, you know. So there's ways that things kind of flare up. It's like we can't necessarily see the gases accumulating under the surface, but there's a moment where it bursts out into flame, you know, and then it becomes visible to us, you know. And I also think that, you know, in addition to those specifically activist spheres, when you were asking me what, you know, figures are inspiring, there are also just like, you know, the determination of a human being in the face of hardships. You know, we go through these initiatory passages and things can become very difficult. And, you know, we need to learn to grapple with those realities. So for that, I would invoke Ada Blackjack. And she was an Inupiaq woman. And here come these white explorers. This is they wanted to go to an island that's north of the far corner of Siberia on an expedition because they wanted to claim it for the British Empire. And so none of the Inupiaq people wanted to go with them, but she was, you know, economically challenged, and so she went with them as the seamstress on the expedition. She wasn't supposed to be anything. And she herself was a product of the boarding school, so she didn't really even have all of the traditional skills, but she must have had some of them because she was the only survivor of that expedition, you know. And she managed to just do, she figured out how to trap and gather berries and do the things that were needful in order to stay alive. And she cared for one of the men, but he was dying of scurvy, you know. And it's just so inspiring to me. She survived, and boats came finally when they could get through, and she'd been there for 2 years with her cat. And then, you know, she was brought back. And so, you know, there's ways in which that kind of just core spirit that
the cat was okay. I'm always concerned about animals in the story.
I know. Well, just, people on Facebook asked, but, you know, what happened to the cat? And I said, I can't believe that having lived only with this cat after the guy died, right, that she would have left the cat behind to starve and die.
Right, right. No, we just want the implicit narrative.
We just have to fill that
part in. Where's the dog? Where's the cat? yeah, no, and I'm so glad you brought up Idle No More, and exactly the ritual brought in, so that it's the evolution of activism. It's like we're not protesters, we're protectors, a really good word change.
Yes.
And the song for people to go search, the fabulous song Idle No More, just gives you goosebumps. It's mm-hmm. so beautifully powerful. Mm-hmm. And we were speaking, Max, you know, backstage about, you know, this unfolding, more potent form of well, I don't even want to call it protest, of protecting, of gathering, you know, we want language and stuff, but you said with rousing music and powerful symbols and, you know,
yeah,
all
with
of
drums
that. Right?
And maybe masks and banners that are highlighting the sacred. It's not, we're not against, it's like we are for life, we are for water, right. We are for human rights, we are for all these things, and we do it in a communal, collective, affirmative way. So, because it's like, I think, knowing now, just referencing what just has gone down in this past few days in Washington, that, you know, okay, so there was a massive fail on the part of the Senate to even just on a minimalist constitutional basis, you know, carry out their responsibilities. And so it's going to take the river. It's going to take a surging of the river of people into the streets. I don't know how we're going to get the passivity yet overcome. So that people can do that. But that needs to happen, that we need to have this joining together become so visible and so enchanting that people want to be part of it, you know, that they automatically join in.
And I told you that when you said this last night, you know, that right at that moment in New York, you know, and we saw this on the Twitter feed, there was a lot, you couldn't see the end of it, right? It went on and on and on, you know, going guilty as charged. And we go, that's good, although it could get a little repetitive after a couple of hours. Some more things. We want some more powerful words, but it's there. and it's the, and it is the Earth herself. It's like what was written about Marie Laveau, and let's bring her in. Hello. You know, that she did not create cultural movements, but a woman of her substance understood what was at stake, saw a role to be played, played it to the hilt, helping to coalesce a scattered and oppressed people into a moment of cultural ecstasy. So I always loved that writing. I'm pretty sure that Michael Ventura wrote that about her. But we don't have to create cultural movements. The Gaia herself is, but for each one of us to see a role to be played and go, all right, we're up for this. You know, and so, and we want, you know, more than a moment of cultural ecstasy, but that idea of blending, yeah, and the rousing quality. So,
and the connection, the connection is really important.
Yes, and how would you see that?
Well, just in terms of being able to join together, and especially over differences, because even if, I mean, Mitt Romney was a really interesting example. This is not somebody I admire in general, but the fact that one Republican only stood up and said, this is wrong, you know, at that moment, that was something that was admirable, you know, and so, you know, I give credit to him for that, in spite of the binders of women and all the other stuff that came before, you know, because you never know who's going to rise up and finally just turn around, you know. And so we have to leave room for that turning around, because that is where connection comes in. It's just that, you know, maybe on many other bases, we're going to oppose what Mitt Romney stands for. But at least here, it's like this is something we can affirm. And it's just like to see that that's the basis of coalition, is where we can come together for the things we are for. And instead of bitterly splintering, which is, you know, this has been a mode of fascist increase, is to keep splitting and turning, you know, the Warren people against the Sanders people against the, you know, that it's just like, okay, we have to stop Voldemort. That's the prime directive right now, you know, and the rest will be sorted out. But we do know that we cannot have Caligula into a second term. It's a full imperial presidency as it is now. Who knows what it would look like if that were to happen? We can't allow that to happen.
We're seeing 144 angry vegans escorting him off stage. But yeah, again, you know, and well, it is like the really fabulous movie Lives of Others, which is about how the sociopathic heart can bloom again when it's in contact with art and Venus. Not everybody, but you don't know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, exactly as you say, you know, and for all of us to cultivate nuance so that we're not into approve, disapprove, you know, vituperative, bilious, because then Trump dust is everywhere, right? It's so very sneaky.
Yeah.
So whatever we speak to another, you know, encourage the good, discourage the bad, you know. But at the same time, you know, there is a lot of, yeah, and so our dedication, because it does take that, oh, help us backstage gods, that we, you know, be disruptors of polarity, liberators of polarity into spiral, into swoosh, into the river, the undulating river. What's that? Is a good thing, and because it is challenging, because, you know, and yeah, they're just, yeah, the things that get our goats, you know, and it is often on social media, somebody going, well, you're posting negative articles. It's like, no, these are critiques and things we should know. You're bashing
absolutely.
People. No. I'm holding, but we got to know everything. You got to know everything, you know, and then, you know,
and nuance.
This is a bad part of this person's sketchy past that we should know about, and here's what might be good, because we're friends of their souls. We're enemies of their personalities or functions in the world, you know. So, yes, again.
What you just said about, like, the, you know, basically transmutation of these negative energies into the spiral. That's a really good script for the Saturn Pluto time, because the Pluto has the power to dissolve and to transmute. It's really ultimately transmutation. You know, there's change at the deepest level, the change of the heart, you know, that affects everything else. And so, you know, having that joined together with Saturn, the structural, you know, there's the potential for that transmutation. I mean, you know, you can play out all kinds of different ways that could be really scary, and that's there too. But it's just like to see the potential of the astrological moment, you know, in how can we shift it, you know?
Right, and
circles,
as alchemists,
not in angles where it's polarized and oppositional, where we're pounding nails down, you know?
Right. Right. You know, and again, you know, part of what we're doing and part of what you are deftly dedicated to is, like, let's track everything back to its originating liberating impulse before it was orthodox, bamboozled, or hoodwinked, and set it free, going, what did you poor little dingbat, what did you, oh, you want it back, I'll set it free.
Right, like so, the mikveh, you know, I mean, there's this reclamation in all these decolonizing movements is to say, what was the original intention, the original sacred intention of it, and then how it got colonized, we have to know that part, you know, it's not like you have to go do this because you're unclean, but instead, it's a spiritual practice that, okay, I release now. Of the last lunation, I release all the detritus. I release the pain, the trauma, the compulsion, so I can be fresh to the next moment. And that renewal to center is something that's a very important spiritual practice. You know, in living water. It has to be water that's moving in nature. It can't be a stagnant pool. Mm-hmm. So, you know, reconceptualizing all of those.
Right. Well, yeah, again, the water, dreams, imagination, for as long as we've had poetic memory, you know, our imagination's always been tied to water. And so we do say, you know, what species would poison the collective water supply? And we go, a species that had lost its mythology of conscious kinship. So only the healing of imagination can heal the ocean, and only the healing of the ocean can heal the imagination. And there we are. But with help, right, with the divinities and the active intelligences, it is part of my love of throwing the word archetype into the cauldron for myself, you know, just because it's an old word, but it was engaged by Jung to smuggle living wild things into academia. Nothing to worry about here. It's just an archetype. So just,
it has to be a Greco-Roman root word to smuggle.
Oh, there you go. Right, exactly. Nothing to worry about here. There's nothing kind of, because it is the autonomy of actual forces of nature that we, you know, that we offer metaphors, incarnational metaphors. You know, I like thinking of all the divinities as metaphoric animations of intrinsic intelligence in nature, and, you know, and shape-shifting, and part of what you do so well everywhere, in Witches and Pagans, right, is again, yeah, exactly what we all feel we know, which is the living, reverent sense of participatory animism. Everything's alive, everything worthy of respect, everything available to form a partnership with, right? And that's so much of what you,
all in relationship.
Let me ask you.
Right?
I mean, that is part of what you, and it's so important now, you know, that we return to participatory animistic kinship after the long journey of having left that and then gone to pyramids and knowledge and the church and the state and the suppression and then psychology, oh my God, and then back, here we are back again, but keeping all the value of the journey. So I want to ask you, so, I mean, something I'm fond of querying, which is when did humans make the underworld a bad place? And it's like, it's got to be when there was a priesthood, right? Because you need fear to do that, as opposed to its soil and roots and the place of initiation.
It's hierarchy. You know, it doesn't even have to necessarily be in the spiritual system, although eventually it will find itself there, but it's like this hierarchical authoritarian impulse that, you know, of control, of having to control something. And it's like, as far as the when part, this is like the same thing that I say when people ask, when did patriarchy begin? Because it's like, where on the planet are you talking about? Because there's all these different time streams, you know, and over here, you know, you can look in Southwest Asia and see patriarchy forming already in the 4th millennium BCE. But then if you come over here, you know, in Sumatra or over there into, you know, the northern Great Lakes where the Six Nations of the Iroquois are, then you see a whole different timeline. So there's there again where, you know, there's not one story or one framework. We have to look in a very multiplicitous way at all the different, all the timelines and all the interweaving. I mean, if you use the weaving metaphor, then there are strands, you know, and it's sometimes one strand by itself doesn't have the power to make everything different, but it's the building up of strands, and then you start to get this pattern forming that is kind of viral. It's kind of like a virus because it gets picked up. It has attractions for people who want to accumulate wealth or want to accumulate power, and so then there starts to be a motivation. This is what we're seeing with the Republican Senate. Everybody is terrified a lot of those people despise Trump, but they're terrified to fall under whack-a-mole. And so they collaborate because they don't know what else to do. You know, they don't have the courage to stand up against it because their individual interests. And so that's how that virus operates. But it's a really complex story, you know, and there's all these interweaving factors because one is patriarchy, one is war and empire, you know, the class systems that develop all these things that interfere with the expression of the sacred. And they really make a very definite push in that direction. This is why religion becomes a form of institutionalizing domination, you know, whether it's male domination, white domination, you name it, you know, is that it is something that goes beyond external systems of control using direct force, you know, like battered women or, you know, stoning to death or all those kinds of things, but it actually goes on the level of internalizing, colonizing people into fearful states where they think God will punish me if I do the right thing, basically, you know, if I stand up for freedom, or if, you know, I help this poor person who's being flogged by the wayside, you know. There's the introduction of fear because the internal controls are saying that the divine itself it's claiming that the divine itself is on the side of domination, you know, and that
until,
you will be punished.
Until now, right? And your blessing, your liberating blessing to that accurate.
We have to discover our true spiritual roots, and you know we can learn that through scanning the cultural record. We're learning it from living traditions. Idle No More is showing the way. All of the different native movements that are they're placing at the center again the sacredness of life as the prime imperative, you know.
Right, and the irresistible call to that part of us that's still there.
Yeah, and so this is what we have to join together for.
Yes, mazbut. Mabsut Mazbut. And I do, before we deconvene, we've got some precious time, but I did want to bring up just some of the patterns. We love pattern tracking and the strands to be woven and all. So you have Mercury quintile Uranus, a 72-degree angle, sacred to Venus, irresistible eloquence, and the capacity to open portals between worlds. And I have Mercury quintile Pluto. So we go, let's all aspire to experiment and tone all our skills. Because I love the quintile. And for all of us right now, the moon is quintiling Uranus. And I'm going to say this because it's so beautiful, but I'll translate it. Mercury quintiles Mars, and then quintiles Vesta on the other side. And Vesta and Mars are 144-degree biquintile to each other. Very beautiful. And it's the magical alternative to any polarizing discourse within us or without. It's eloquence whereby to open portals between worlds and invite in what is needed. So you have that. I have that. We all have that available. And we go, all right, we're up for that, because it's a non-polarizing form of communicating that bestows upon all of us the capacity to be a tuning fork that hums in others. And so they go, oh, I see that now. Yeah, okay. So again, unlike priesthoods, right, guiding people to their own autonomy. Very wonderful. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then the last thing is, you know, the Vesta, our dedication, and Mars. So it is beautiful. Mars at 23 Sagittarius is imaged the bluebird of happiness perched on the gate of a little cottage. And that's Nelson Mandela's rising sign, because through all that he endured, he knew he was going to be happy. And that kept him happy along the journey, because he knew he was going to be happy. And it says to all of us now, if we dedicate to Vesta in Taurus, keeping the community of all beings flame alight, then we will be happy too, saith the biquintile. Anyway. Just wanted to put that out for as a proffering to yourself and our team out there.
Yeah, because I mean we don't want to get caught into a distraught state, which just basically bleeds out energy. You know, it's just like we have to find peace as we move through all of this. We have to have that peaceful center somehow. That's a yoga. I can't say that I'm there entirely yet, but I'm working on that.
Well, we're all befoibled and working on it. That's right. Yes, because and also, you know, magnetizing is part of the Venusian skill. You know, magnetizing whatever we love, our dedication to it, you know, strengthens our internal dedication, strengthens our outer hum. May it be so. So in this increasing frequency where everything before us is trying to help out the humans, we ought to kill them or heal them, but let's do both. You know, again, it's our dedication to going, all right, dance us into place with these allies. Thank you for the increased frequency of call and response. And serendipitous synchronicity available. You know, all right, we're willing, and we're humbled. We are definitely humbled. We can't get ourselves out of this, our rogue species, we can't get ourselves out of this pickle by ourselves. It's by ourselves that got us into this pickle. Right, so, in your upcoming beautiful thing, I want to let people know about this again. You know, February 29th, 7 to 9:30 p.m., in Richmond, California, and you can find out.
Yeah, it's going to be at Cobiz, near the Richmond BART, right on top of the Richmond BART. So
right,
and
you said it's perfume free. It's wheelchair accessible. It's completely skookum.
Yeah, yeah, and lots of images that will feed the spirit.
Ah, that's what we want. Absolutely. So this is splendid. I'm so glad that we are all incarnationally coinciding. Thank you, fellow heretic. Right, we remember heretic is a term of praise and priest existence because it means free thinker.
It means choice.
So that's
Greek.
Wonderful. Is there okay? We have two-ish minutes. Is there anybody else you want to invite in now to for us to feel or be inspired by?
Mm. Well, you know, I would call out for the Wiyot elders and on your Eureka, California. This is a place of terrible genocide, and they just celebrated the restoration of Duluwat Island in Humboldt Bay to their sovereignty. This is something that took some work, but they got the city council to give over there. So there are victories like that one. The ancestor Grandma Aggie, who's just a little further north from there, who was a Takelma's Susla woman, Siletz woman, who was one of the 13 grandmothers, now an ancestor, and all that she achieved, also a water protector and a salmon protector. Those teachings are out there. And I had this woman, I don't know her name, she's called the Woman of Poltit. She was an Albanian mountaineer woman who she fought for her house because the patriarchal society, her husband died, and she was just a widow, so they were going to boot her out and bring them all in, brothers.
We're on our way out, and everybody prime the pump, and Maxima Acuna in Peru, and the Orca grandmothers that are the survival of their pod, and everything. It is such a delight to cahoot with you, Max Dashu. You're fabulous. Website is suppressedhistories.net. I'm coyotenetworknews.com.
That's something to think about.
Right, and thanks always to the backstage team, Lucretia Burton and the board op team. I'm Caroline Casey, and we will reconvene next week. Thank you so much.